We're going to continue with biblical prophecy and postmillennialism. Historical expectations according to the Bible. This is the 11th part. It's actually the 6th part of Daniel. It's still dealing with the prophetical. We're going to finish up Daniel, and for the most part, we'll be done talking about the Old Testament for now. We will have occasion in the future to turn back to some things, but this is going to complete our survey for the moment. Director of Public Worship, a public prayer before the sermon. We're commanded to pray for the propagation of the gospel and kingdom of Christ to all nations, for the conversion of the Jews, the fullness of the Gentiles, the fall of Antichrist, and the hastening of the second coming of our Lord, for the deliverance of the distressed churches abroad from the tyranny of the anti-Christian faction, and from the cruel oppressions and blasphemies of the Turk. Daniel 11 is picking up a couple of themes. One is, we're going to begin looking at it, and we'll see that Gabriel is really still in the fore, and it begins with a confirmation of that idea of spiritual warfare, that there's this contest going on, that somehow Michael has been appointed an angel to represent Israel in the spiritual realm. Gabriel is the angel that's representing Israel abroad. Wherever Israel is in the heathen nations, Gabriel is taking up the cause of the people of God. And they're in a conflict. He's mentioned a conflict between between Michael and Gabriel and the prince of Persia and the prince of Greece. So there's a spiritual battle going on in the unfolding of these empires, these four kingdoms. Remember as well, and I'm going to come back to this, but Daniel took time out in chapter 9 to give us an exposition of the things leading up to the advent of Messiah and the beginning of the Messianic era. And so at one point, I am going to point out to you that in this accounting, he really skips over that. And he does for, I think, a number of reasons, not least of which is he's already talked about this in some detail, the Messianic kingdom. And Daniel's not really interested in giving a huge explanation of all of that. Daniel now is really going to move the attention, if you remember in chapter 8, the attention was on that little horn that arose in the east. And I know there's some people think that that's Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus Epiphanes is a type of that little horn. He does appear in this chapter. I'll point him out on our way through. But again, he really is just a type. What we're dealing with here is the future as it's going to develop out of that third kingdom. And we're going to see that transitioning that will occur. Because both the development of the little horn in the east and the little horn in the west, that was in Daniel 7, both of these have bearing on the future of the Messianic kingdom. The fourth kingdom of the Romans dissolves into 10 kingdoms, and one of them, out of three of them, actually arises a little horn in the west. In the east, we have a different little horn. So, with that in mind, I want to look at Daniel 11, 1 and 2.
Daniel 11, verses 1 and 2. Also I, in the first year of Darius the Mede, even I, stood to confirm and to strengthen him. And now will I show thee the truth. Behold, there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they all. And by his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Grecia.
Now, the eye here, eye in the first year of Darius the Mede, that's a reference telling us this is the beginning of the Medo-Persian Empire. Remember, there was first Babylon and then Medo-Persia. Darius is a Mede. This is at the beginning of this Medo-Persian conflict, or not conflict, rule. When the empire is transferred to them, when they, through conflict, take it from the Babylonians, when they establish their rule in Assyria. So, Darius is the one who's in view, and Gabriel is telling Daniel, I'm going to tell you something here now, after Darius, they're going to stand up yet three kings, and then there's a fourth. Now, the three kings are Cambyses, Smyrnas, and Darius Hystaspes, son of Hystaspes. They're the three that are in view, and they're not really our concern, but we know who they are. It's more important that we know that you know that we do know who they are. This is a very exacting bit of prophecy going on here. Daniel 11 is one of the most precise bits of prophecy, and I'm not intending on getting into every nuance in the text because there's a lot here, and we really want to finish up Daniel. The fourth, however, is not the fourth, including Darius, it's the fourth after him. We're talking about Xerxes. Xerxes reigned from 485 to 465 BC. And the language that he will stir up all against the realm of Greece is talking about him stirring up the Persian Empire. So at the end of it all, Xerxes is stirring up the Persian Empire to go and fight Greece. In fact, we're told, and that's this is really the fourth king. We know this about the fate of the fourth king. He assembled, in fact, the largest army that we are aware of in antiquity. It was some 2.3 million people. And he took them to attack Greece. And he lost. In fact, at the Battle of Salamis in 480 BC, his entire fleet was destroyed. So this is a blow. And this is how, if you want to understand historically how we're going to move from this transition from Medo-Persia to Greece, Xerxes is really the reason for this. So Daniel's getting a little bit more detail here, at least in part because he's very close to this time. And the information he has is very pertinent to the people of God. Remember as well, as we're going through, that these prophecies are going to keep coming back to Israel and then from Israel to the church in the New Testament era. The reason being, history is really revolving around the church. Whether we're talking about the Old Testament or New Testament, it's revolving around the church. So, we want to look next at Daniel 11, 3 and 4.
Daniel 11, 3 and 4. And a mighty king shall stand up that shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken, and shall be divided toward the four winds of heaven, and not to his posterity, nor according to his dominion which he ruled. For his kingdom shall be plucked up, even for others beside those.
Okay, so let's look at a few things here. The mighty king that's talked about here is clearly Alexander the Great. And this dominion that is referred to, the great dominion. Remember, this is a language going back through the book of Daniel. It's referring to the Gentile dominion over Israel in particular. Daniel's concern is to know when Israel is going to be delivered. And these four kingdoms that are the great empires of the world in succession, part of the problem is, one by one, they're occupying or exercising authority in and over Israel. And so as we go into the New Testament era, it's going to have an impact. The concern is the land of Palestine. And he does according to his will. What does that mean? Well, nobody can really stop Alexander. He is unstoppable by any man. And yet when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken. And divided into the four winds. We talked about the four winds, right? Macedon, Thrace, Syria, Egypt. That was Macedon. These were the four generals. Cassander, Thrace, which is Thrace is Greece and Turkey and part of modern-day Belgium. Thrace is taken by Lysimachus. Seleucus takes the area of Syria, and the Ptolemies take Egypt or the south. So they're going to the four winds, and notice it says not to his posterity, because Alexander had no able successor at all. He had nobody who could have taken over or taken up what he was doing. There was no successor in his family line. In fact, when he dies, his son, who was quite young at the time, was killed by Cassander, the one who is going to rule over Macedon. And he takes him out and has him killed because he doesn't want any future contender for the throne. So it's not in his posterity, nor is it according to the dominion which he ruled, because the fact is, none of them are ruling to the extent that Alexander did. And yet, the influence of the Greek Empire is going to be felt until the Romans get a grip on it. And that's a lot of what's going to go on in this chapter, is telling us, giving us really details of how this inter-Greek squabble, if you will, these four generals end up in all kinds of battles and contests and their descendants, until finally the Romans put an end to all of that and the Roman Empire takes over. I want to point out when that occurs, but it's important to see what's going on here. We're going to look at Daniel 11, 5 and 6.
Daniel 11, verses 5 and 6. And the king of the south shall be strong, and one of his princes, he shall be strong above him and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. And in the end of years they shall join themselves together. For the king's daughter of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement. But she shall not retain the power of the arm, neither shall he stand, nor his arm, but she shall be given up. And they that brought her, and he that begat her, and he that strengthened her in these times.
So there's several things going on. The king of the south is talking really about the Ptolemies, in particular when this happens, when this breakdown occurs after Alexander's death and they're scattered. Essentially what happens is Seleucus is the one that's being referred to as one of his princes. And what the reason he becomes one of his princes is he fumbles. He ends up, in fact, losing Syria for a time. Now, the Ptolemies at this time are controlling Palestine, that is Israel, the land of Palestine. Ptolemy sets up Seleucus and actually helps him. He helps him recover his dominion. He helps him get Syria back. And after Seleucus gets back in power, he ends up going to war with Lysimachus, who was ruling over Thrace. So you see, these generals are not getting along. Ptolemy took in Seleucus and tried to help him, but these generals are not necessarily getting along. Seleucus takes on Lysimachus, defeats him. And this is why this scripture says that he shall be strong above him. That is, he ends up being stronger than Ptolemy because he ends up ruling not only over Syria, but over Thrace. He ends up with, you know, two of these governing parcels of the previous Greek Empire. And so it's a great dominion that he's exercising. In the end of the years, they shall join themselves together. The king's daughter of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement. What this is talking about, Seleucus, when he dies, Antiochus, his successor is named Antiochus. This is not the one we're going to focus on. This is not Antiochus Epiphanes. This is a predecessor to him. What happens is, in order to firm up the kingdom, he divorces his wife and he marries the daughter of the Ptolemies. But when it says, neither shall he stand nor his arm, but she shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begat her, and he that strengthened her in these times, what it was talking about is this. When Ptolemy dies, Antiochus actually recalls his previous wife, his first wife. And that precipitates, as you might expect, the first wife was not so happy that she had been sent into exile for this political marriage. She makes sure that Ptolemy's daughter and the child born of her are both killed. And that leads us then to Daniel 11, 7 and 8.
Daniel 11, verses 7 and 8. But out of the branch of her roots shall one stand up in his estate, which shall come with an army, and shall enter into the fortress of the king of the north, and shall deal against them, and shall prevail, and shall also carry captives into Egypt, their gods, with the princes, and with their precious vessels of silver and of gold, and he shall continue more years than the king of the north.
Yeah, what the result of all of this is, Ptolemy's son, who's also named Ptolemy, he decides he's going to avenge the death of his sister and her child. And so he then goes north and begins to mete out punishment. He prevails in his going north. He actually is winning. And in the course of it all, if you remember the first three kings, as four kings we talked about, the last of whom was Xerxes. The first one, they're Cambyses. Cambyses, when he was, in fact, the leader of the Medo-Persian Empire, he had gone in and taken a bunch of the Egyptian gods out of Egypt. This Ptolemy, who's avenging his sister's death and the death of her child, he recaptures those gods and brings them back into Egypt, and he's lauded as a wonderful leader to the Egyptian people as a result of this. Now, this challenge does not go unnoticed by Seleucus, or the leader of the Seleucid family. So we want to read what happens in Daniel 11, 9.
Daniel 11:9. So the king of the south shall come into his kingdom and shall return into his own way.
Yeah, what this means, the Egyptian king makes his forays into the province of the Syrian king. The Ptolemies are going into the Seleucid Empire. And in Daniel 11:9, what we see is a reversal. Ptolemy prevails and brings back these gods that were taken by Cambyses, but now the Seleucids strike back and recapture from Ptolemy a lot of these provinces that were taken when he went north, when he got these gods back. So he's driven back and he's dispossessed of all the spoils of war, at least property-wise. What he got out of it were the gods. He got their golden idols and all of that. All right, Daniel 11, 10 to 15.
Daniel 11, 10 to 15. But his son shall be stirred up and shall assemble a multitude of great forces, and one shall certainly come and overflow and pass through. Then shall he return and be stirred up even to his fortress. And the king of the south shall come, shall be moved with a choler, and shall come forth and fight with him even with the king of the north. And he shall set forth a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into his hand. And when he hath taken away the multitude, his heart shall be lifted up, and he shall cast down many 10,000s, but he shall not be strengthened by it. So the king of the north shall return, and shall set forth a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come after certain years with great army and with much riches. And in those times there shall many stand up against the king of the south. Also the robbers of that people shall exalt themselves to establish the vision, but they shall fall. So the king of the north shall come and cast up and take the most fenced cities, and the arms of the south shall not withstand, neither the chosen people, neither shall there be any strength to withstand.
Right, so what we have going on here in a nutshell, and I don't want to go through every bit of this in detail, but this is really chronicling the struggle between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies and their empires, particularly between Antiochus the Great, who is the father of Antiochus Epiphanes, and Ptolemy the Fourth and Ptolemy the Fifth. Now, in this struggle, during this struggle, for a time, Judea comes under the control of Syria, the Seleucid Empire. But it's then regained by Egypt. And that's why there's so much attention given to this, because in the center of the struggle is really who is going to control Palestine, Promised Land. All right, Daniel 11, 16.
But he that cometh against him shall do according to his own will, and none shall stand before him, and he shall stand in the glorious land, which by his hand shall be consumed.
Yeah, the finally, what happens at the end of all of this is what we're told here in verse 16. The final conflict is that Antiochus returns, he repels Ptolemy, he retakes Judea. Judea then comes back under the Seleucid Empire. It becomes their province to rule. Now remember in the background in all of this that the backstory is since the captivity, Israel has not been self-governed. They're not really ruling themselves. And this is really setting up part of that that anticipation that so many Jews are hoping for with the advent of Messiah. They're hoping that when Messiah comes, he's going to restore the kingdom to Israel. But that's not really how the Messianic era is going to develop. It's not going to start out as a political kingdom. It's going to start out as a religious movement that ends up, as we'll see in the book of Revelation, ends up, in fact, exerting great political influence and controlling the ideas of men. All right, what intrigue do we have in Daniel 11, 17?
Verse 17. He shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom, and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do, and he shall give him the daughter of women, corrupting her, but she shall not stand on his side, neither be before him.
Yeah, here's what this is talking about. as this conflict is going on between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, Roman power is arising. And Antiochus the Great, who is the king in Syria, he's the one who's running the Seleucid Empire, he begins to have some problems with the Romans, and he decides he's going to seek some kind of an alliance with Egypt. And he does so by betrothing his 11-year-old daughter, whose name was Cleopatra, to Ptolemy V. Now, this is Cleopatra I. Cleopatra that you may be familiar with in history is Cleopatra VII, and she's much later. But she is, in fact, in this line. Mark Antony and Cleopatra and all of that. That's much later, however. This Cleopatra is betrothed. She's a daughter of Antiochus the Great. She's given to a Ptolemy. And why does the verse say that he shall give him the daughter of women, corrupting her, but she shall not stand on his side, neither before him? Well, it turns out that after she marries him, somewhere along the line, she decides she's going to support her husband rather than her father, and the Ptolemies end up congratulating the Romans as they are enacting victory after victory against the Seleucid Empire. So it's not going well with him. What was supposed to be solidifying a political alliance, this betrothal, in fact, becomes a matter of family betrayal. All right. Daniel 11, 18 and 19.
Daniel 11, verses 18 and 19. After this shall he turn his face unto the isles, and shall take many, but a prince for his own behalf shall cause the reproach offered by him to cease. Without his own reproach he shall cause it to turn upon him. Then he shall turn his face toward the port of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found.
Yeah, what this is talking about is this. Antiochus finally ends up in a full-on head-to-head match with the Romans. Antiochus the Great. And he's defeated. He turns his face unto the isles. The people of the isles are the people of Greece, Turkey, and Bulgaria. Asia, Thrace, Greece. Those are the areas that are being talked about. If you look at a map, you'll see that all along that area of Asia Minor, the coast of Asia Minor up to Greece, it's just a bunch of little islands, one of which, the biggest of which, is an island called Cyprus, which is going to come up in a moment. If it doesn't work, he's defeated as he's going after these folks to his west. It's just not working for him. So what happens is he turns his face toward the fort of his own land. He turns to flee. But what ends up happening is along the way back, he, in the course of trying to plunder a temple to Jupiter, he enrages the people of the city, and they kill him. So he stumbles and he falls and he's not found. He's gone. We want to look now at Daniel 11, 20.
Daniel 11, verse 20. Then shall stand up in his estate a raiser of taxes in the glory of the kingdom, but within few days he shall be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle.
Yeah, this raiser of taxes is going to rise up instead of Antiochus the Great, is a son of Antiochus. Again, it's not Antiochus Epiphanes, it's one of his other sons. It's the elder son. And this refers to, the raiser of taxes refers to him sending out his treasurer to plunder places under the control. One place that he was sent to plunder was the Jews' temple. So again, this is why this is of concern to Daniel. This concerns the Jews. He's plundering their temple. He's taking all the gold and silver of the temple. He's trying to remove all anything of value in order to reinvigorate the Seleucid Empire. If you think about it, what had happened with his father is that there had been a continual series of battles back and forth, and that's an expensive proposition. It's expensive today. It was expensive in the ancient world. You have to pay for all of that somehow. You have to pay your soldiers. You have to be able to feed them. You know, an empty armies traditionally are said to travel on their stomachs. If you don't feed them, they're not going to fight. So you need money. You need stuff to accomplish that. But what happens is, and this is what's referred to, but within a few days he shall be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle. This treasurer, sent out by the son of Antiochus the Great, returns. And having seen, evidently, some of the wealth of the kingdom, he decides maybe he deserves it and he could do perhaps a better job. So he actually poisons Antiochus' son. And that happens about 12 years into his reign. It's not a long reign. It's a brief period of time, a few days. We're talking about a few years prophetically. It's not a long, drawn-out period of time. Okay, we're going to look next at Daniel 11, 21 to 29. And there are a lot of things here. I'm just going to point out a few things along the way, but we need to look at this character.
Daniel 11, verses 21 through 29. And in his estate shall stand up a vile person to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom. But he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. And with the arms of a flood shall they be overflown from before him. And shall be broken, yea, also the prince of the covenant. And after the league made with him, he shall work deceitfully, for he shall come up and shall become strong with a small people. He shall enter peaceably even upon the fattest places of the province, and he shall do that which his fathers have not done, nor his fathers' fathers. He shall scatter among them the prey and spoil and riches, yea, and he shall forecast his devices against the stronghold even for a time. And he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army. But he shall not stand, for they shall forecast devices against him. Yea, they that feed of the portion of his meat shall destroy him, and his army shall overflow, and many shall fall down slain. And both these kings' hearts shall be to do mischief, and they shall speak lies at one table. But it shall not prosper, for yet the end shall be at the time appointed. Then shall he return into his land with great riches, and his heart shall be against the holy covenant, and he shall do exploits and return to his own land. At the time appointed he shall return and come toward the south, but it shall not be as the former or as the latter.
Okay, so what we have here is, in fact, the only explicit description of Antiochus Epiphanes, son of Antiochus the Great. He is an enemy of the Jews. We see toward the end that his heart is against the Holy Covenant. And there are reasons for that. We'll talk about that when we talk about verse 30 in a minute. But he is the one who stands up in the estate of his brother, when his brother's poisoned. He's the one who actually ends up moving to the front of the line in succession. So the poisoning doesn't actually profit the treasurer. It actually ends up falling to Antiochus Epiphanes. And he is pretty vicious. He doesn't really care about people, evidently. He's concerned about consolidating empire. He is going to give that Seleucid Empire its big push. Now, if we look at Daniel 11:30.
Daniel 11:30.
Good.
For the ships of Kittim shall come against him. Therefore he shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the Holy Covenant. So shall he do, shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the Holy Covenant.
Yeah, this is... this actually has some relation to Numbers 24:24.
Numbers 24, verse 24. And ships shall come from the coast of Kittim, and shall afflict Asher, and shall afflict Eber, and he also shall perish forever.
Kittim is Cyprus, and at this time, that's really part of the province of the Romans. So what is being described here in verse 30, and it's alluded to in Numbers 24:24, although Numbers 24:24 takes this a little bit further. But Daniel 11, verse 30 is talking about what happened in this contest between Antiochus Epiphanes, the king of the north, and the Ptolemies. There's been this rivalry, and Jerusalem, Judea, is really in the middle of this. Whoever's in ascendancy tends to control the Holy Land. Well, the Romans go after Antiochus Epiphanes. In fact, they demand that he leaves Egypt. When, in fact, the Roman ambassadors showed up and got their hands on Antiochus Epiphanes, we are told that what they did is they actually drew a circle in the sand around him and told him he couldn't leave that circle until he made up his mind what he was going to do. And it didn't take him very long to see the handwriting on the wall, as it were, and decide that he would leave Egypt. So he backs down, he leaves. When he leaves, however, he's not going to leave Judea. He's not going to leave Israel. What he does, in fact, is referred to in some of the earlier verses. He goes into Israel, into Judea, Palestine, and he starts passing a bunch of measures and enforcing a bunch of laws against the true religion. He makes an effort to stamp out the Bible, to see that there's no open expression of the Jews' religion. He doesn't want any of it. He's trying to get rid of it. In Numbers 24:24, what we're told is that the Romans really end up supplanting the Greek Empire. And it's interesting, in fact, that the same year that the Romans catch up with Antiochus Epiphanes and force him out of Egypt is, in fact, the same year the Romans conquer Macedon, which is the principal part of the Greek Empire. Philip of Macedon was Alexander the Great's father. And they conquer that, and that really spells the end of the Third Kingdom. It was the end of Greece at that point. And so this expelling of Antiochus Epiphanes out of out of Egypt and out of the Ptolemaic Empire actually turns into part of the solidifying of their control over the whole Greek Empire. And from here on out, in fact, what will happen? And it goes down to that Cleopatra the VII that I mentioned a few minutes ago. They're in league with Rome. The descendants of Ptolemy end up, in fact, doing that intermarrying with the Roman Empire. And so they become an integral part of the Roman Empire as it transitions from the third to the fourth kingdom that both Daniel saw and Nebuchadnezzar saw. So that's what's going on here. Now, the fact is, that before we move into verse 31, and verse 31 is actually I think, pretty clear as to its reference. There is an entire gap between the rise of the Roman Empire now and, as we'll see in verse 31, the end of the temple in Jerusalem, the destruction of Jerusalem. The reason why it's not being covered here is very simple, I think. It was already covered in Daniel 7, 8, and 9. All these things were covered in more detail. What's missing here was actually, in some respects, held under a microscope, and the consequences of them were spun out a bit. How do we know that? Well, let's look at verse 31. I just want to break that off for a minute. I know I've got a bunch of group together, but I just want to want to look at that for a second, and then we'll finish reading through. So somebody can read verse 31, and then
Daniel 11, verse 31. An arm shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary for strength, and shall take away the daily sacrifice, and they shall place the abomination and make it desolate.
Yeah, that's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, and that comes in at the end, really, of Daniel 9. That's marking the end of that advent of Messiah. We know that that's the beginning of the kingdom of stone. So that's already there. It's already been talked about as far as from the kingdom of stone perspective. From the perspective of what's going to happen to the Romans, it's already been drawn out in Daniel 7. And even the rise of Islam, which we're going to come back to in a moment, that's been mapped out in some detail in Daniel 8. So we want to look first then, let's continue with Daniel 11, 32 to 35.
Daniel 11, 32 to 45. And such as do wickedly against the covenant shall be corrupt by flatteries. But the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. And they that understand among the people shall instruct many. Yet they shall fall by the sword, and by flame, by captivity, and by spoil many days. Now when they shall fall, they shall be holpen with a little help. But many shall cleave to them with flatteries. And some of them of understanding shall fall, to try them, and to purge, and to make them polite, even to the time of the end. Because it is yet for a time appointed.
Okay, stop there. This is all really, verse 31, we have the destruction of Jerusalem, and verses 32 to 35, what we have really is a description of a lot of early church struggles. What's happening with the church, with the split between believing and unbelieving Jews, and even a number of things that are going on in the early church with the rise of heresies and all the need for all those early church councils as they're fighting. They're getting some help from the empire, which we'll see from a different perspective. But this is important that we understand that some of this is going to be discussed in more detail in the book of Revelation. Daniel's getting a taste of this. But then something else occurs. His attention is turned to something else. We want to look at verses 36 to 39.
36 to 39, and the king shall do according to his will, and he shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished. For that is determined shall be done. Neither shall he regard the God of his father, of his fathers, nor desire of women, nor regard any god, for he shall magnify himself above all. And in his estate, but in his estate shall he honor the God of horses, and a God whom his father knew not shall he honor with gold and silver and precious stones and pleasant things. Thus shall he do in the most stronghold for the strong God, whom he shall acknowledge and increase with glory. And he shall cause them to rule over many and shall divide the land for gain.
Okay, so this section now is describing the rise of Islam. The king shall do according to his will. It's talking about Mohammedanism, Muhammad. This is not talking about Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus Epiphanes does not cast off regard for the God of his fathers. He doesn't do the kinds of things that are talked about here. This is a different thing. This is picking up that theme of that little horn that was going to come out of the east now. He's turned his attention to that again. And so we see the rise of Islam. We see the vigor, but also the worldliness of it. It's a strange God, and he's trying to supplant the true religion with this. That's the gist of these verses. That's what's going on. That's what's in view. All right, we want to look finally at verses 40 to 45.
And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships. And he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. He shall enter also into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. But these shall escape out of his hand, in Edom and Moab, and the chief of the children of Ammon. He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. But he shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and Ethiopians shall be at his steps. The tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy, and utterly to make away many. And he shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain, and he shall come to his end, and none shall help him.
Yeah, this is also talking about Islam, the divisions that Islam faced, particularly the division into Sunni and Shiite, which is a north-south type of division when we look at these empires. They're taking over, and they do take over. You see all these countries that are listed, the area is listed. This is all overspread with Islam. They've taken over all of this, and they still have it. We're told that in the end, nobody's going to come to help. Islam is going to come to an end, but he plants the tabernacles of his palace between the seas in the glorious holy mountain. That almost certainly has reference to the mosque of there's a mosque in Jerusalem, the Temple Mount, beside the Dome of the Rock that have been around for since the 600s, at least. Since the late 600s. The Temple Mount in Jerusalem, that one, in fact, probably was an early Christian church that was converted into a mosque. There's some questions about that. But they're planting these mosques. They do the same in Constantinople. Right now, they take over Constantinople, they take St. Sophia, and they make it a mosque. Now, this is what they've done as they've taken land away from Christians. But this is the rise of Islam, and it's spread in this region. It's coming out of that Seleucid empire, both the Seleucid and the Egyptian portions of the empire. That's where it's focused, and that's where we have this Sunni and Shiite battle going on. The Egyptians favor one, the Persians, or now the Iranians, favor another. They have different views on this Islam, but these are the descendants of two wings of this divided Greek empire. And that's where it's coming from. So that's what we have. What is Antiochus Epiphanes a type of? Well, he's a type of Muhammad. And Muhammad is particularly a form of Antichrist arising out of Judaism. It is a monotheism with a vengeance. And rather than acknowledge their ancient Trinitarianism, the Jews, in fact, help give birth to Islam. Whereas, on the other hand, in chapter 7, Romanism is the Antichrist, which is coming out of Christianity. It's coming out of that Western part when the Roman Empire divides itself. And that theme will again, in fact, both of these themes will come up again in the book of Revelation. We'll see both aspects of this coming. We're going to look at Daniel 12:1. Daniel 12 is short, and we're going to take it up with the rest of our few minutes here.
Daniel 12, verse 1. And at that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince which standeth to the children of thy people. And there shall be a time of trouble, such as never was there was a nation, even to that same time. And at that time thy people shall be delivered, every one that shall be found written in the book.
Yeah, what Daniel 12:1 is referring to is, remember, that last verse in the previous chapter talks about the end of Islam. Islam is not going on forever. I know they're building their mosques like they think they'll be here forever. Hopefully they will make good Christian meeting houses, because we'll need them during the millennium. Anyway, the twilight of Islam, we're told here there's going to be great trouble for the people of God. But at the end of this trouble, there's going to be great deliverance, right? That's the whole point, that thy people shall be delivered, everyone found written in the book. And so there's something about the end of Islam which is going to precipitate the deliverance of the people of God. That's one thing he has in view. We'll look now at verses 2 to 4.
Daniel 12, verses 2 through 4. Many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt. And they that be wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament, and they that turn many to righteousness as the stars forever and ever. But thou, O Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book, even to the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased.
Yeah, here again, at the end, what is it when this deliverance comes? Well, Daniel says it's going to be like a great resurrection of the church. And it's going to come at a time, not only when it's the end of the four kingdoms that he's talked about, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome, but also at the time of the end of the two horns, the little horn that arises in the west out of the 10 divisions of the Roman Empire, and that little horn that arises and faces a pleasant land in the east. So at the end of all of that, that's what he's talking about. There's going to be a great resurrection of the church. Now, that, I believe, is in fact Daniel talking about what John talks about when he mentions the millennium. That there's going to be a great resurrection of the church. All right, Daniel 12, 5 to 7.
Daniel 12, verses 5 through 7. Then I, Daniel, looked, and behold, there stood other two, the one on this side of the bank of the river, and the other on that side of the bank of the river. And one said to the man clothed in linen, which was upon the waters of the river, how long shall it be to the end of these wonders? And I heard the man clothed in linen, which was upon the waters of the river, when he held up his right hand and his left unto heaven, and swear by him that liveth forever, that it shall be for a time, times and a half, and when he shall have accomplished to scatter the power of the holy people, all these things shall be finished.
So Daniel is redirecting our point of reference to, first of all, here's Gabriel. And Gabriel says, look, there's going to be a time, times and a half a time. 3.5 years, 42 months, 1260 days with a day for a year. 1260 years. Now, when should we begin to count that 1260 years? Well, Daniel describes that as when he shall have accomplished to scatter the power of the holy people. So there's something about the scattering of the power of the holy people. So any commencement date has to, in some respect, take into account that concept. Now, one of the problems here with pinning down an exact date is that most of the time, it's in retrospect that we can see very clearly the beginning of these things. There are, in fact, and one of the interesting things about these numbers is there are evidences that some of these numbers are almost cyclical, and that there are potentially several typical fulfillments before we reach the actual fulfillment. So while it's looking toward the end, yet there are things that are shadowing forth that total fulfillment prior to that. So that complicates it when we look back. It's only really probably going to be when we get to the millennium where we're going to see very clearly. Although as we get into the New Testament, there are some hints that we're given, some ways that we can maybe pin this down a little bit more. Look at Daniel 12, 8 to 10.
Daniel 12, verses 8 through 10. And I heard, but I understood not. Then said I, O my Lord, what shall be the end of these things? And he said, Go thy way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed till the time of the end. Many shall be purified and made white and tried, but the wicked shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand.
Yeah, Daniel he talks about the time of the end of the Gentile or the heathen dominion over the church. So it's not just the four kingdoms. We're not just looking for the end of the Roman Empire. We're looking for the end of Romanism in the West and the end of Islam in the East. We have to have an eye to that. Now, he gives us finally at the end a couple more points of reference that are also hints to this effect. And these are not mentioned in the New Testament, but in fact, these are things that are in some respect helpful in directing us as points of reference. So look at Daniel 12, 11 to 13.
Daniel 12, 11 to 13. And from the time that the daily sacrifice shall be taken away, and the abomination that maketh desolate set up, there shall be 1,290 days. Blessed is he that waiteth and cometh to the 1,335 days. But go thou thy way till the end be, for thou shalt rest and stand in thy lot at the end of the days.
I think there are a few things that we can take from this. At the end of the 1,290 days, we're told that there is, in fact, that which would indicate repentance, deliverance, and even reconstruction of that which pertains to the people of God. And if we understand from what he said with the 1260-day period that somehow that pertains to the twilight of Islam, which is probably also, as will appear in some New Testament considerations, pretty close, if not very closely coordinated with the fall of Romanism. But there is this idea here that there's, as we saw in Daniel 12:1, that there's going to be great trouble. So there's going to, this 30, between the 1260 and 1290, we've got 30 years. And apparently in that 30 years, it begins with great tribulation, and it ends with the converting of the Jews. And then he gives us another number of 1,335 days. We're adding 45 days, which is really 75 years from that unbelief. A 30-year period for conversion of the Jews, and we're told that happy is he that comes to that. This is probably talking about the millennium, when the great deliverance is. And so I think that we're looking at 45 years that will comprise the time when the nations in general are being converted to Christianity. So that we've got a period of great tribulation, which we need to determine when it started, and then we've got a 75-year transition from unbelief to the millennium. The first 30 years begin with great tribulation. In other words, at the 1260 point, as Romanism and Islam are falling, it will be the lowest point in the history for the church. 30 years later, we're going to see that the nation of the Jews have been converted, and at that point, that will begin the process which will take evidently 45 years for the Gentile nations to be converted and to be brought in. And that would explain why there's a blessedness for he that waits and comes to that 1,335 days. That's the time of the great deliverance, which John, as we'll see, refers to in Revelation as the millennium. So that's where Daniel takes us. He takes us through the history of the world. I think, interestingly enough, he has some hints, some indications. John, I don't think, is the only one who talks about a millennium. I just think that Daniel hints at it because it's so far off from him, and that's not his purpose at this point. His purpose is to have his book sealed up until the New Testament era, and then for it to start to unfold, the understanding to unfold. And that's all because we need history. Without history, we can't really know. We can't come to a proper understanding of what's going on. So next time, we'll begin looking at the New Testament. I want to begin looking at some of Jesus' parables about the nature of this messianic kingdom. Because we've really, Daniel's left us in a bit of a lurch. He's left us with a very precise time when the messianic era will begin. But he hasn't told us a whole lot about it, except to tell us that there's going to be these troubles until we get past this period of time, and pointing us to the millennium. But there's a lot of obscurity in between. He just passes over a lot of that. That's material that will be developed both in terms of Christ's parables, the various eschatological discourses in the New Testament, and finally in the book of Revelation. So we'll look at that. We'll begin looking at that stuff next, Lord willing.
Stillwater's Revival Books is now located at puritandownloads.com. It's your worldwide online Reformation home for the very best in free and discounted classic and contemporary Puritan and Reformed books, MP3s, and videos. For much more information on the Puritans and Reformers, including the best free and discounted classic and contemporary books, MP3s, digital downloads, and videos, please visit Stillwater's Revival Books at puritandownloads.com. Stillwater's Revival Books also publishes the Puritan Hard Drive, the most powerful and practical Christian study tool ever produced. All thanks and glory be to the mercy, grace, and love of the Lord Jesus Christ for this remarkable and wonderful new Christian study tool. The Puritan Hard Drive contains over 12,500 of the best Reformation books, MP3s, and videos ever gathered onto one portable Christian study tool. An extraordinary collection of Puritan, Protestant, Calvinistic, Presbyterian, Covenanter, and Reformed Baptist resources. It's fully upgradable and it's small enough to fit in your pocket. The Puritan Hard Drive combines an embedded database containing many millions of records with the most amazing and extraordinary custom Christian search and research software ever created. The Puritan Hard Drive has been produced to assist you in the fascinating and exhilarating spiritual, intellectual, familial, ecclesiastical, and societal adventure that is living the Christian life. It has been specifically designed so that you might more faithfully know, serve, and love the Lord Jesus Christ, as well as to help you to do all you can to bring glory to His great name. If you want to love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, then the Puritan Hard Drive is for you. Visit PuritanDownloads.com today for much more information on the Puritan Hard Drive and to take advantage of all the free and discounted Reformation and Puritan books, MP3s, and videos that we offer at Stillwaters Revival Books.